Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
Timing, they say, is everything. My being here this morning proves I don't have it.
In Dublin, the morning after, the night before in the House of Commons, John Major knew he really wasn't in the right town.
But it's always a pleasure to come to Dublin, and I'm delighted to be here with you this morning on such a slow news day.
But he addressed the overnight chaos up front.
Whether you are a Remainer or a Leaver, no one can welcome chaos. So I think it is a time in the UK for everyone to reflect and consider. Time to turn to reality and not fiction. Time to turn to reason and not ideology. We need to calm the markets. We need to protect the economic well-being of the British people. We need to protect our national interest.
And in his opinion, the only way in which that can be achieved is taking advantage of the exit from Brexit signpost just put up yesterday by the European Court.
We now need to revoke Article 50 with immediate effect. The clock, for the moment, must be stopped. It's clear we now need the most precious commodity of all, time. Time for serious and profound reflection by both Parliament and people. There will be a way through the present morass. There always is. But in our national interest, we now need to take some time to find it. And I hope and I trust that we will.
And as Theresa May goes to the European mainland looking for changes to the withdrawal agreement, John Major says that he sees two which might be helpful, but he wasn't saying what they were, and he doubted the EU would budge on them anyway.
I think the wiggle room in the withdrawal agreement is probably very limited indeed. I don't think the wiggle room in the political declaration is so limited. I'm not going to speculate. I don't think that would be helpful to the Prime Minister, and I wouldn't want to add difficulties to what is already a difficult situation for her. But I can certainly see things that would be changed in the political declaration that would be helpful. Whether they would be significantly helpful, I don't know. I can think of at least two things that could be done to the withdrawal agreement. I'm not going to tell you what they are. That would be helpful. But I doubt the European Union would be prepared to offer them. But both of them, if offered, could make a significant difference. So I think there is scope in the withdrawal agreement, but I don't think that scope can be exercised because I think Europe has boxed itself into saying the deal is the deal and it is unchangeable, which I suspect is what European leaders are saying at the moment. And if that is the case, it is unchangeable. And we move on to the political declaration. That certainly is capable of being changed. And I suspect if Mrs. May asks for changes there, she may get some.
He threw Brexit and Brexiteers in with other forms of popular nationalism on the rise in China, Turkey, Austria, Hungary, Poland, and the US.
It manifests itself in xenophobia. It is anti-foreigner, anti-immigrant, anti-Europe. It is careless of the misfortune of others. It opposes overseas aid. It lacks human empathy or compassion. The drumbeat of its motto is self, self, self. All this needs to be resisted. There is a better way to go.
He lamented the UK's loss of influence as America pivots away from Europe and towards Asia, at the same time as Britain had chose to pivot away from Europe.
Britain will suddenly be seen by the world as a mid-size, middle-ranking power that is no longer supercharged by her alliances.
And while attention has focused on the self-harm caused by Brexit, he was conscious too of the harm that Brexit caused Europe.
Europe loses its second largest economy. It loses the nation with probably the greatest and deepest worldwide foreign policy reach of any European nation. And it loses the most significant counterweight to the Franco-German policy alliance. A counterweight, let me add, that has often spoken out against policies opposed by other smaller European nations reluctant to challenge any consensus themselves because they are net beneficiaries from European funding. Any weakening of a united Europe, while China grows in power, while Russia misbehaves, while America becomes more distant, cannot be in the best interests of all Europe, including the United Kingdom.
Sir John, while it's self-evidently in Ireland's interests that Britain remain in the EU, and if not in the EU, in the single market, if not in the single market, in the customs union, I wonder, what is your response to the apparently growing sentiment in the other 27 member nations that, frankly, good riddance to the UK, notwithstanding what you said about the European Union being weakened by Britain's departure, there does seem to be a growing feeling that the EU might be better off without this reluctant, quite frequently obstructionist member that's having constant crises of faith.
Well, sometimes to have a grit in the oyster is quite useful. And Britain has often been the grit in the European oyster. For example, when the euro was introduced, when it was agreed at Maastricht that there would be a euro, I declined to join because I thought the structure of the euro was going to lead to trouble. I could not see how countries like Greece could compete in the same monetary zone with the same exchange rate as Germany. And clearly, the euro should not have begun until such time as those countries were able to compete in the same currency zone. And we said that. We were alone in saying that. I decided on that basis that we wouldn't join the euro. I think in retrospect that we were right. The difficulties the euro have had because of the different competitive ability of the German economy and that some of the smaller economies is profound. And it has destabilized a large part of Europe, created massive unemployment in southern Europe, and created also, in my experience going around Europe, a very substantial anti-German feeling in many parts of Europe. Now, we were right about that. It is useful to have someone who will stand out against the consensus and say no, even if they are a pain in the neck, which is what very delicately you implied about the United Kingdom. So I don't apologize for that. I think it is quite useful. And I think from time to time, we were the protector of small nations who were reluctant to speak out against the broad consensus themselves and were content for Britain to do so. So I think it is quite useful. I actually believed it in terms of forming my cabinet. I had quite a few grits in that oyster, as I recall. And it is a useful thing to have. I tease a bit, but it is a useful thing to have. And if people are a little fed up about the fact that sometimes we disagree, I think they should look at the reverse side of that coin, how often we may have been right, and how, if we had been listened to, some of the problems that have arisen in Europe would not then have arisen in the form they now have.
Brexiteers speak of the limitless trade opportunities with the likes of America, China and India. John Major was sceptical.
Can we form trade deals with the United States? Of course we can. That's, I think, no doubt. But how much it is going to be a benefit to the UK, I'm less sure. Because the principal demands of the United States will be twofold. Access to our agricultural market, in which the big Midwestern corn dealers may well be able to undercut the East Anglian corn dealers who are one-tenth their size in acreage. I look forward to eating chlorinated chicken. I look forward to seeing what happens when the American beef market moves into the British beef market. I think all that would be disastrous for farmers and for rural communities generally if domestic British farming were damaged. And the other access they will demand will be into the National Health Service in terms of drugs and everything that goes with it. So I'm not sure how much net value a trade deal with the United States would actually prove to be. It would be quite small, I think. Perhaps there would be a net value, but I think it would be quite small and certainly wouldn't replace 53 trade deals elsewhere. And then, of course, there's India. Of course, a free trade deal with India would be extremely good. But it's quite difficult to negotiate a free trade with India at the same time as you're telling them you don't want their students or their people to actually come and live in the United Kingdom. That is not the best negotiating posture I have ever seen. And as for China, I'm not entirely sure that 65 million Britons are high on the agenda of 1.3 billion Chinese. So I am a little skeptical.
He reflected at length on how the relationship between Britain and Ireland would now have to change and what had to be done to restore power sharing in the north.
And let me be frank, it is an indictment of both the DUP and Sinn Féin that they have not yet reached an accommodation.
Blame for the impact of Brexit on the north he laid squarely at the feet of the DUP and Theresa May.
Brexit has already inserted its very own poison into the turbulent politics of Northern Ireland. It begins with the DUP's support for Brexit, which is flatly opposed by most of their business base and by the majority of voters in Northern Ireland. It continues, I am sorry to say, with the confidence and supply agreement the DUP have reached to support the minority Conservative government at Westminster. It may, on occasions, actually do so. But any formal support has the secondary and inevitable effect of undermining the UK government's role as an independent and honest broker in solving any problem between the two traditions in Northern Ireland.
And unlike so many other visiting politicians from the Tory party, John Major was keen to impress that he had read his history books, and that is why he saw the danger to Ireland represented by Brexit.
If I recall correctly, and I do, the start of the Troubles was the murder of customs officers at the border in the 1960s. We don't want to give any conceivable chance of turning the clock back in Northern Ireland after so much has been done over so long and after there has been such an improvement, not perfect by any means, but such an improvement in the relationships within Northern Ireland and between the North and the South. It simply is not a risk that should be taken, in my view. The belief that because we have had no violence in Northern Ireland for 18 years, that it is gone forever, is fatuous.
On the prospect of Irish unity, he suggested politely that we do the maths.
I don't know how best to put this tactfully. It's quite an expensive proposition, a united Ireland, which may not be foremost in everyone's mind all the time, but believe you me, if it became close to a reality, it most certainly would be. And of course, you cannot do that sort of thing without broad consent. That has always been the position. It's been the position that successive governments have taken for a very long time. And I think the most important thing is not a united Ireland, but harmony between North and South and the freest flowing trade and life between Irishmen north and Irishmen in the south. I think that is more important than changing the map a little to incorporate the north back within the south.
He was particularly poignant on the need for British and Irish officials to maintain relations and trust once Britain has left the EU and they were no longer rubbing shoulders day to day in Brussels.
The two sides will no longer be able to bond over common causes in Europe. It was where I first met Albert Reynolds, it was where we became friends, it was where we learned to trust one another. But no longer will Irish and British ministers be able to meet and speak there privately and productively for their joint interests, and indeed vote together for their joint interests in Europe. No longer will ministers and officials meet daily in Brussels. The loss of this contact is unquantifiable but profound. Some say that familiarity breeds contempt. Our Anglo-Irish experience as partners in the European Union suggests our familiarity is more likely to breed trust, agreement, and peace.
The breadth of his understanding of Irish politics was a pointed contrast to some of his successors in the House of Commons, as was his clear view of the middle to far distance. This was the grown-up view of Anglo-Irish relations, an alliance that has to be maintained whoever is or isn't a member of any club.
Our links far exceed politics and trade, important though they are. And let me conclude with this thought. As a Briton, I say Ireland is important to us, and in or out of Europe, that will not change. Our duty, if we are to part from the European Union, is to build on our relationship and not let it fragment. We British owe that to Ireland, and we owe it to ourselves. We can do this, we should do this, and we must do this.